There's a lot of that in the U.S. every single year. How do we think about servicing infrastructure that's been put in place? So we have a whole play in infrastructure services. Infrastructure itself has cyclicality to it. If I'm going to go out and I'm going to build a wind farm or I'm going to build a power plant, that goes in cycles. The servicing of the infrastructure once it's in place is not cyclical at all. And whether GDP grows 2% or contracts 2%, you have to service the wind farm, because if the turbine's not turning, you're not generating power and energy.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice.
Welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast by Gold Rock Capital. My name is David Ram, and I am a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth investors in Israel and around the world. And with me today is Adam Weinstein, Managing Director and CFO at New Mountain Capital, a private markets investment business in the U.S. with over $30 billion in assets. Welcome, Adam.
Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And for our listeners that are not familiar with you or with New Mountain, maybe you can give a two-minute version of who you are, what your firm's up to, et cetera.
Sure, great. Appreciate the opportunity to talk here. So I'm Adam Weinstein, as you said. My firm, New Mountain Capital, I've been here for 18 years. I'm the COO and CFO, which really means just helping to run the firm on a day-to-day basis, kind of across our people, strategy, process. Make a lot of the it's kind of a compilation of things that have been accumulated over the last almost 20 years. So, and New Mountain Capital has been in business since 1999. We're about $37 billion of AUM. We have really three verticals. Our largest and kind of what we call the trunk of the tree is our private equity business, which has a control strategy and a non-control strategy associated with it, where we're buying businesses in what we call defensive growth industry sectors. Sectors of the economy that have the wind at their back, that are strong, that are acyclical. We have a longstanding credit business that started in 2008. That's about $10 billion of AUM today. And that business is lending to companies that we don't own. So we find a great company. We'd love to buy it. Somebody else pays a higher price. You know, we can come in and be the lender. And then we have a triple net lease business where we're buying the critical infrastructure plants of businesses that have a real estate footprint, and where we believe that the business itself is in a good industry, is survivable and strong. So those are the three businesses. We really picked our spots to try to be very deliberate about where we spend time. And the key to our whole strategy has been a unified investment team. So whether we're looking at an enterprise software business to buy on the private equity side, control or non-control, or we're going to be a lender to an enterprise software business, or probably a bad example in real estate, but if an enterprise software business had a plant that they that we were going to buy the plant and lease it back to them, the same team would be looking at that. So it's a unified underwriting investing team, which we think gives us a unique perspective in the sectors where we focus.
Very, very interesting. And a lot of the sectors you focus have real estate, I can only assume. That's interesting. So I wanted to talk to you about your flagship business more than anything else, and more broadly, the industry as well that you're operating in the private equity business. There's been a lot of, flack given to the industry over the past number of years by the mere fact that rates have been very low, zero basically in the Western world. Growth has been high due to massive amounts of liquidity in the market, allowing for companies to grow faster and change hands more often from one private equity fund to another, et cetera. And a lot of people looking inside that industry from the outside are thinking about the industry today in 2023, moving forward into the next decade or so, and looking at a market with higher rates and perhaps more anemic growth. So I wanted to talk to you about thinking about as an investment opportunity in private equity now, not so much in the past. So first and foremost, I wanted to ask about how you guys think about it. Do you guys worry about public market performance? Do you guys think about the public markets? Because as investors, a lot of times we think about Whether I'm investing in public markets or private markets in the equity space, I don't care that much. I want equity exposure. I want to partner with the economies. And if I do it in the private space, I'm taking a liquidity risk or a liquidity hit, so I better get paid for it. But how do you guys think about it? Do you think about your performance or your industry as a relative value to the equity markets, or always making a similar amounts of money no matter where we are in the cycle?
I think the answer is both. I think that you do have to, over a long period of time, outperform public equities if you want to make the case for why you're a good place for people to put money, to your point on thinking about the illiquidity that comes when you're a private equity investor. I mean, I would say that private equities and asset classes become less illiquid. You know, there's a very strong secondary market that has played out. And so I do think large institutions that are in private equity, you know, do look at their exposure a little bit differently than they did 15 years ago when it was really hard to get out, you know, hard to get out of positions. But generally for the regular way investor, it is illiquid to your point. So I think you have to look at it on a relative basis to public markets. And the case should be that you should be outperforming consistently the public markets. And so I think in years where the public markets completely have a rebound, you can underperform a drop. But I think in almost all other years, you really have to be, you know, outperforming. But there isn't also an absolute bar. I don't think that if the public markets slump for the next 10 years and we just see ourselves, I'm not predicting this, I'm just saying, you know, if the public markets were just down every year for the next 9 of 10 years, I don't think your answer is, hey, I beat the public markets. The public markets were -8% and I was -6%. So I think that there's an absolute return. A lot of people point to the hurdle rates that they put in their preferred returns. You know, hey, should I be able to get you in all cases, in all markets, at least an 8% net return? We're striving for higher. You know, we've been higher, but I think there's an absolute bar and there's a relative bar that I think people have to make their case.
It's funny that you mentioned the hurdle rates, because it's finally coming back into a place of normalcy, in a sense that the original hurdle rate was there to match the cost of capital. So over the past 15 years, when the cost of capital was nothing, I think a lot of equity managers were frustrated by the fact that there's a hurdle rate in place when the cost of capital is zero. Now the cost of capital is a lot higher, the hurdle rate may actually make a bit more sense again. And to that point on the cost of capital, when you think about, you know, one of the components that private equity managers typically use in order to generate value is using the leverage, right? They buy a company for $100, they only put up $50 of equity, they borrow the other 50, they have low interest rates on that $50 of borrow, so they can leverage the growth of that business, and it could be a very creative approach. Now, looking at the cost of capital, which is much higher than it was for over the past decade or so, it's going to reduce, you know, the ability to magnify those returns. So how do you think about that? If everyone's trying to look at their historical returns and trying to match them for the future, how do the managers now think about that in terms of moving forward? Are they going to be much more selective in the companies that are going to grow faster? Are they borrowing less? Are they borrowing the same amounts, but just going to take the hit? How are they thinking about it?
Well, so it's a good question. And if I go back to one lesson of history, when you go back to the great financial crisis, the difference between the market environment then and the market environment today, there's lots of differences. But the difference as it relates to debt is you would see a company in 2006 that you'd have a private equity firm that may put up $25 and borrow $75.
Yes.
And the difference with the environment we're in pre the last, call it 9 months, right? So if you go back to the first part of last year, or even take, you know, late 21, where the market environment was still kind of strong and moving forward, the private equity markets, you know, before the public markets had its downturn, we see this as a lender, right? So I'm just talking about the market overall. You would see a lot of people paying big prices for businesses that were growthful, but they would be putting up 70% of the equity and only borrowing 30%. And so I do think you, as a general market matter, have seen private equity firms putting up a bigger percentage, so much lower loan to values. And that, again, that plays into the lending universe. But so I do think that people have been used to, over the last 3, 4, 5 years, as pricing has increased. If someone bought a business for 12 times EBITDA, and then they were buying it for 14 times EBITDA, out of those two multiple turns additional that they paid in price, you know, you had 70, 80, 90% of that oftentimes coming from equity. So I think people are in a better position now. A rapid rise in interest rates, I mean, it's causing, I mean, the S&P, the public markets, the companies in the public markets also are levered, right? And so, you know, everybody's feeling the crunch, a little bit of interest expense, you know, but the way I like to think about it is, if you have, you know, take a $1 billion business, right? You have a $1 billion enterprise value business that you bought. Let's say you put up $700 million of equity and you borrowed $300 million. To my point on equity's been bigger than debt. On that $300 million of equity, each 1% of additional interest rate is $3 million.
Right.
So if you think about the $700 million I have on the line, if this is a good, fundamentally good company, where that company has cash flow issues now because of interest rate, you know, coverage issues, you know, I'm going to support $3 million, $6 million, $9 million of additional capital, you know, as interest rates have risen. So I think it's less of an issue. And I think that, you know, our particular firm, you know, we've always used less debt than the market has given us. You know, we're at 3.8 times debt to EBITDA over the last three funds we've invested. But I think that the market is in less of a, you know, this specific point has not been the key to people paying big prices and growing businesses. Interest rates going up, you know, is obviously going to cause more of a crunch for everybody.
Yeah. So you guys are averaging about 3.8 times in your funds. And I think the market is probably more like 5 to 6, if I'm not mistaken. So that's a pretty substantial difference from one from your business to the others. In terms of expectations around growth, because the way we look at it at Gold Rock is, you know, whether you're buying a company in the public markets or in the private markets, in general, there are three main ways to make money, at least how we think about it, which is, you know, leverage, growth, and multiple expansion. So with multiple expansion, let's put that aside. Oftentimes, guys typically underwrite to no multiple expansion or even multiple contraction. And leverage is a component we just spoke about. And the third is growth. So you're really reliant on growth. And if you look at the broader macro environment, there's probably an expectation. I'm not sure about you guys if you're thinking about this as well, but there likely is an expectation of slower growth than we maybe experienced historically because of the cost of capital, because of inflation or other aspects. So how do you guys think about the expectation of growth of companies you're targeting and the future of their next fund or the future of the industry in general?
If you're a private equity firm, the benefit you have is you are able to pick your own spots, right? If I am an S&P investor, I obviously can pick, I want to be in this sector, I want to be that sector, right? But if you are a cyclical chemical business that is publicly traded, you are a cyclical chemical business, right? And you're going to have your ups and you're going to have your downs.
Yeah.
And so I think the reason, and I'm not even just talking about my own firm, I'm just saying generally, when we think about private equity overall, I think for the overall majority of quality GPs are picking spots that do have growth. And that is picking industry sectors where the secular tailwinds are with them. And so our entire focus of our firm is our sector process, is figuring out what areas of the economy are growing, where do we want to spend time. We actually had our sector meeting this week. We spent 2.5 hours talking through the sectors we want to focus on. If you pick growthful sectors, yes, I think we all get it, right? If the economy goes in the wrong direction, growth slows, you know, if you're invested in an industry or want to invest behind an industry that is seeing 10, 12% growth, we all acknowledge that might go to 8, 9% or 7, 8%. But if you have if you're part of a fundamental change that's happening, or where there's a market share gain, you're in a sector that is just underpenetrated. So even if growth could slow in its core, there's a lot of growth potential because you're finding new markets. There's a lot of, you know, openness in greenfield. You know, that will allow you to grow greater than the economy. I mean, our view has been in good times or bad times, we want our businesses to be more growthful. You know, we haven't been trying to grow the businesses in our portfolio at, you know, GDP for, you know, since inception.
Yeah. Now that's interesting, because sector orientation is really obviously a very important piece of the puzzle, because when an investor buys the S&P 500 or whatever it is in the public markets, they're getting a diversified industry exposure. Some industries may perform, some not. So as an example, everyone's had very big challenges outperforming the S&P, especially in public market managers. And I think a lot of it relates to tech, right? The past 10 years, software has been the focus. I'm not sure what the next 10 years will be, but the past 10 years have been software. So if you had a lot of software exposure, you did better than any other sector orientation. So I guess that's a big, that's definitely a big part of it. And cyclicality, I guess, could also be a big part of it. So in terms of that, you know, how do you guys think about, you know, you're in your business in general, how do you guys think about the focus? Are you trying to carve out, you know, consistently a very specific piece of a broader economy?
Yeah, so that's, you know, when we think about the broader economy, we think the overwhelming majority of industry sectors we're going to stay away from. So we don't need to be in commodity chemicals. We don't need to be in energy. We don't need to be in heavy manufacturing. You know, we can stay away from those things because we can pick, you know, great sectors. We're focused on 10 to 12 sectors. We love things that are, again, irrespective of a bad economy, people are going to be focused about on healthcare costs. So we have a whole theme on healthcare cost containment, which doesn't mean don't have people go to the doctor. It means, because you can lower costs that way, right? It means how do we more efficiently look at the healthcare billing system to take out fraud, waste, and abuse in the healthcare billing? There's a lot of that in the U.S. every single year. How do we think about servicing infrastructure that's been put in place? So we have a whole play in infrastructure services. Infrastructure itself has cyclicality to it. If I'm going to go out and I'm going to build a wind farm or I'm going to build a power plant, that goes in cycles. The servicing of the infrastructure once it's in place is not cyclical at all. And whether GDP grows 2% or contracts 2%, you have to service the wind farm, because if the turbine's not turning, you're not generating power and energy, right? And so we're those are the types of themes or things like digital transformation. To your point earlier, what we like about digital transformation is that is just a wholesale shift that's happening. People are using digital applications. People are doing marketing, traditional marketing, in a very, very different way. If marketing spend overall shrinks, which it almost always does in a downward market environment, our share of that wallet in the digital marketing platforms that we have should grow as a much bigger piece of the pie. So we will grow, you know, and the sector itself will grow because it's a cheaper, more efficient, better way to do it. And it's got a trend, you know, at its back. So that's the way we think about it, is that you have the ability in private equity to pick your spots. And then the last thing I would say is, which we haven't hit on, which is key to our own story, and I think a lot of our competitors, is the ability to actually take the destiny and put it in your own hands, because we have an entire value creation engine. We have 30 people at the firm who are focused every day on adding value to middle market businesses that we spend time on. Lots of other firms have it organized very similarly. And this is a toolkit. We call it our operating partner toolkit. It's a toolkit to enhance value. So we have a business that had 30 different offices in the US. It's a professional services business, had 30 different offices in the US. Every office sold differently, had different marketing materials, had different bill rates that they would talk to clients about. So us having a person at our firm who is focused on go-to-market strategy and is helping unify a sales pitch for 30 offices, that's something that a $400, $500 million enterprise value business just didn't have the capability to do before. So further from the industry sector, we can also enhance the growth curve by driving value add at the companies.
Yeah, just to follow up on that one point, I wonder, you know, I can only imagine it, I would say it better, which is that the entrepreneurs themselves, the owners of the companies of which you purchase, they probably find that to be quite valuable prior to the acquisition. They probably think, oh, I'd rather work with fund A, fund B, or fund C based on your sector focus, based on your value creation team. Because, you know, I see it, you know, in Israel as well. I see it, I'm sure it's in the US as well, where if, you know, a company wants to sell majority control stake to a third party, they want to make sure that owner is going to be in good hands. The company will still be in good hands once the transaction is done. They don't want it to just go to the crapper.
That's exactly right. And you know, we've bought over half our businesses from founders, where the founder was meaningfully, you know, still involved in the business, who had big economic ownership. And that's exactly right. People do care about it. I think that private equity sometimes gets a bad reputation. And yeah. I think the overall numbers, which I have seen, you know, are really positive on job creation, net of job losses. You know, we publish a social dashboard where we talk about that ourselves. But, you know, the industry overall, the metrics actually look good, because when you're buying overall growthful businesses, you're increasing headcount, you're growing the teams, you know, these things are all happening. So I think that's exactly right. And that resonates with founders of businesses who say, I spent 30 years building this, I'm now going to move to a chairman role, or I'm going to just stay on the board, I'm not going to be as active anymore. I want a partner that's going to make me proud of what this business is in 5 years from now.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times, it's also, they're going to keep a meaningful economic stake, you know, even though they're selling control, you know, they're going to keep a meaningful stake. So they also care about economically.
Yeah. I think the reason why, I mean, maybe this is a bit personal, but my first experience or my first exposure to the private equity markets, I think, was the movie Pretty Woman. So that was a bad introduction. I'm not sure if you remember that movie, but Richard Gere was like, you know, one of those takeover sharks, not a very positive figure in the movie. So that was my first experience. I'm sure that was many people's experiences as well. So who knows?
Well, it was. And listen, that is a little bit how the 80s and the 90s portrayed.
Yeah. Gordon Gekko.
Big business, right? It was less private equity. He didn't have exactly. Gordon Gekko. He didn't have a firm. I mean, he didn't have people trying to add value. He was trying to, you know, pull apart businesses to make money, you know, on the parts.
Exactly.
I agree with you that is not what private equity is about. And look, at you know, we're now a firm of over 200 people. You know, I think private equity 25 years ago sometimes was a firm of 10 people or 15 people. They weren't thinking about value creation in the same way. I think it's a big focus, definitely a big focus for us. I think it's a big focus for many others as well.
You also mentioned something earlier, Adam, which I thought was quite interesting, about the liquidity of the market and how the nature of the liquidity has changed due to the expansion of the secondary space in private equity. And not only secondary, but in fact, you know, there's been a lot of elements around private equity where a lot of different funds, different strategies have been raised recently. You know, the thing called, you know, GP stakes, or things like GP-led secondaries or continuation vehicles, all these different kinds of almost like services to either the LPs or the GPs. First of all, I want to get your impression if it's a good thing, a bad thing, if this helps you as in the industry or not. And I'll add a couple of pieces of color around that. One is, one of the attractions has been private equity is fundamentally less efficient than public markets. So it's much more of a bilateral negotiation on price. But when you have a massive amount of capital and different types of strategies all around you, it creates a more efficient pricing model where maybe your ability to get a good price versus a market price is a bit different, and maybe it'll hurt returns. So I wonder if all this capital, all these strategies that are all around you, has it created a better environment for you as a manager, a more challenging environment? How do you think about it?
I think that it is. So on balance, I think it's a good thing. There's always a but. So I think it's a good thing, but I think it's got to be done the right way. I think the idea that someone would have a continuation fund where they'd be contributing an asset at less than fair value because they want to, you know, have better, you know, they want to have economics that maybe are more beneficial to the people that are now at the firm versus the people before. I think, yeah, you have to look at each individual case, but I think it all goes with the point that as you bring more liquidity to the asset class, I do think the divide between what people think about private equity versus the public markets, that gap in returns that you need to have, the outperformance you need to have, you know, will narrow. So I think private equity, if it does just as well, will look relatively better. And I think that when you give LPs an option to, hey, this asset's been held for 9 years, it's a great company, you've made 2.5 times your money, but it's going to take 5 more years to grow this 3 times your money from here. You may not want to run with us on that. That's okay. We can get you out now. You know, I think, again, if done the right way, if value is fair, you know, if you give your investors time and you treat them with respect on it, I think all these things that are emerging are good. And I think as they've emerged, there's a lot more players going into the business and raising capital, right? So as you bring in more capital, it's going to be more competitive, which is just going to accrue to the benefit of the LPs, right? Because pricing will get better because the leverage, you know, the leverage will less lie with the GPs doing it. So I think that there's a market environment that is showing. I've been saying this for 20 years. As you bring more liquidity to the asset class of private equity, you also open up the aperture of those that are willing to invest in the asset class that maybe weren't willing to do it before because they don't feel like, hey, I'm stuck in a 15 or 20 year fund because it's going to take so much time for you to realize all the assets.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense what you're saying. And on a personal level, you know, we're not a massive institution, but it happened even to us once where one private equity fund was selling an asset that we had exposure to another fund, which is very, very common. And amazingly, we had exposure to both funds. So we're getting the pitch book, you know, from the seller saying, what a great deal we're getting. We're ripping these guys off. We're getting a great multiple. And then I get the memo on the acquired, oh, we're getting the best value. We're ripping these guys off. It's great. So it was pretty funny. It only happened to me once, as far as I'm aware, but it was, I can only imagine the institutional guys experience that a lot. So continuation vehicles or different solutions actually can enable LPs to stay in longer and not, you know, crystallize a lot of carry, at least maybe partial carry, but not all the carry right away. And they can maybe tax can be delayed, et cetera. So there are some advantages for those continuation vehicles. It's interesting.
Well, that's exactly right. There's frictional cost in selling assets to another yes. sponsor, another GP. And look, they may have their, you know, we've bought some of our great stories of great successes that we have had have mm-hmm. come from, we bought it from a private equity firm. They might've been a lower middle market firm. They built it to a certain level and now we've built it, but that's exactly right. Rather than in my example, I just gave before let's say we own an asset for 9 years and we think the 5-year picture from here is really bright. You know, it's almost, you know, the business so well after 9 years, the why sell it now
yes.
when you can make a great return from here, right? And so to your point, you delay taking your own carry, you don't crystallize economics, there's no frictional cost, you know, there's some legal cost in setting up an entity and getting elections from investors, et cetera, you know, but you really open up the ability to compound returns at, you know, at better levels with less frictional cost.
That's exactly right. I completely agree. I think you always have that first board meeting after a new company investment, right? So it's like you have all those moments where like, oh my gosh, what did I get myself into? So you kind of skip that part if you're doing a continuation strategy. So coming back to, you know, the sector orientation, the thinking, you know, what are the aspects around private equity, which is very different in private equity markets versus public equity markets as well, the way we think about it at least, is that it's virtually impossible to be tactical, at least on an LP basis. I mean, for us, I can't be tactical so well, but maybe you guys can. But when you guys are you know, deploying a 10-year vehicle, which on average, you know, the industry is longer than 10 years, but let's just call them 10-year vehicles. When you think about that and you're looking at the macro market environment and you're having your 2.5-hour meetings about various sectors, how do you think about tactical investing or shorter term investing in a market environment that really, you know, it's challenging to be tactical when you're investing a 10-year fund?
Well, I think it comes from long, very, very long amounts of time being spent in, you know, this meeting starts the sector process, right? But then yeah. teams meet weekly, every other week. We've been doing most of these sectors, you know, have been sectors we've been focusing on for years. And we really are looking at the trends that are happening. So things definitely change over time. But if you're doing the work and putting in the effort and you're talking to people in the marketplace and you're getting executives on your team and advisors, you know, you can pretty fairly see the next 5 to 7 years. That's the way we think about it. You know, you'd love to see the next 10 years because yes. when you sell in 5 years, you hopefully could sell it to someone who also sees a bright next 5 years. But let's just say over the next 5 to 7 years, I think it comes from doing the fundamental deep research work. You know, you can see the trends that you believe are going to outperform, and those trends are going to outperform because you've done the work to see why they're going to outperform. And then you can be very tactical about the assets you want to own, right? You can proactively say, I love this company and I don't like what this company has to offer, or this company is in the sector, but they're in a more challenged geography that has other issues, right? So once you do the work on the sector, then you can kind of proactively try to find the businesses within the sector you want to own.
That's great. So, I mean, oftentimes on this podcast, what we try and do is get our guests to give us some kind of a practical, focused idea. So have that being said, we're talking about a challenging environment moving forward in terms of rates, inflation, growth. You got to pick your partners well. You got to pick your market segments well. Give us an idea, not a company necessarily, of course, but, you know, maybe a specific sector that you're looking at and saying, this is a sector over the next 5 years we think is going to be a real interesting growth outperformer, even in this challenging market environment.
Yeah, so, I'm definitely not overly bullish. I think inflation takes longer to slow down than people are, you know. I think the federal government, the U.S., only has so many tools in its, in its toolkit to be able to try to combat inflation. So I'm with you that I think it could be a challenging few years. I think, and I would say two things, right? I think anything that is focused on reducing cost is always going to be good in an inflationary time. That might be an outsourcing trend. So if you have anything associated with, hey, there's a business service that can do something cheaper, more efficiently than a business itself, I think those are good places to be, because I think the outsourcing trend, people thinking, hey, I don't want all that headcount here, I'd rather have you have, the headcount. I think those are great places to spend time. We've done, a lot in those areas, from fundamental, HR outsourcing to we can just do this process more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And then I think anything, I am still less making a call on software, right? I think technology overall is really important to pay attention to. Who are going to be the innovators? What's going to happen? I've spent time just more personally to read on what's going on and things like quantum computing and the ability to solve some of the most complex issues and narrow them down to linear algebra. Like, I think focusing on technology, not just going in and I'm going to just own Google. I'm not trying to pick a company, but looking at businesses that have already have a strong foothold, that have a reason to exist, and where they have some technological capability that is going to move the whole universe to, them or their competitors, I think are great places to spend time.
Interesting. I think the U.S. government agrees with you on the last point, because that's why they probably did that Semiconductor Act recently to try and bring home productivity on innovation. We can't always compete with where the rare earths are, where the energy is in the ground, but we can definitely compete with the innovation side in the Western world. So that's great. Adam, this has been fun, enjoyable. Really appreciate your insights and your thoughts. And to all the listeners, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
All right, thank you.
Take care, Adam. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.